destiny and desire, and even the heart of man acquiesced. The European guest house stood 200 feet above the water on the crest of a rocky and wooded spur that jutted from the jungle. By the time Aziz arrived, the water had paled to a film of mauve grey, and the boat vanished entirely. A sentry slept in the guest house porch. Lamps burned in the cruciform of the deserted rooms. He went from one room to another, inquisitive and malicious. Two letters lying on the piano rewarded him, and he pounced and read them promptly. He was not ashamed to do this. The sanctity of private correspondence had never been ratified by the East. Moreover, Mr. McBride had read all his letters in the past and spread their contents. One letter, the more interesting of the two, was from Heslop to Fielding. It threw light on the mentality of his former friend, and it hardened him further against him. Much of it was about Ralph Moore, who appeared to be almost an imbecile.
A hand on my brother, whenever suits you. I write to you because he is sure to make a bad bunderbust.
Then,
I quite agree. Life is too short to cherish grievances. Also, I'm relieved you feel able to come into line with the oppressors of India to some extent. We need all the support we can get. I hope that next time Stella comes my way, she will bring you with her, when I will make you as comfortable as a bachelor can. It's certainly time we met. My sister's marriage to you, coming after my mother's death and my own difficulties, did upset me, and I was unreasonable. It is about time we made it up properly. As you say, let us leave it at faults on both sides. Glad about your son and heir. When next any of you write to Adela, do give her some sort of message from me, for I should like to make my peace with her too. You are lucky to be out of British India at the present moment. Incident after incident, all due to propaganda, but we can't lay our hands on the connecting thread. The longer one lives here, the more certain one gets that everything hangs together. My personal opinion is, it's the Jews. Thus far the red-nosed boy. Aziz was distracted for a moment by blurred sounds coming from over the water. The procession was underway. The second letter was from Miss Quested to Mrs. Fielding. It contained one or two interesting touches. The writer hoped that Ralph will enjoy his India more than I did mine, and appeared to have given him money for this purpose. My debt, which I shall never repay in person. What debt did Miss Quested imagine she owed the country? He did not relish the phrase. Talk of Ralph's health. It was all Stella and Ralph, even Cyril and Ronnie, all so friendly and sensible, and written in a spirit he could not command. He envied the easy intercourse that is only possible in a nation whose women are free. These five people were making up their little difficulties and closing their broken ranks against the alien. Even Heslop was coming in. Hence the strength of England, and in a spurt of temper he hit the piano, and since the notes had swollen and stuck together in groups of threes, he produced a remarkable noise.
"Oh, oh, who is that?" said a nervous and respectful voice.
He could not remember where he had heard its tones before. Something moved in the twilight of an adjoining room. He replied,
"State doctor, written over to inquire, very little English,"
slipped the letters into his pocket, and to show that he had free entry to the guest house, struck the piano again. Then they reached their bungalow, low and enormous, the oldest and most uncomfortable bungalow in the civil station, with a sunk soup plate of a lawn, and they had one drink more, this time of barley water, and went to bed. Their withdrawal from the club had broken up the evening, which, like all gatherings, had an official tinge. A community that bows the knee to a viceroy and believes that the divinity that hedges a king can be transplanted, must feel some reverence for any vice-regal substitute. At Chandrapur, the Turtons were little gods. Soon they would retire to some suburban villa and die exiled from glory.
"It's decent of the great man,"
chattered Ronnie, much gratified at the civility that had been shown to his guests.
"Do you know, he's never given a bridge party before. Coming on top of the dinner, too. I wish I could have arranged something myself, but when you know the natives better, you'll realise it's easier for the Burrasab than for me. They know him,
They know he can't be fooled. I'm still fresh, comparatively. No one can even begin to think of knowing this country until he has been in it 20 years. Hello, the mater. Here's your cloak. Well, for an example of the mistakes one makes, soon after I came out, I asked one of the pleaders to have a smoke with me, only a cigarette, mind. I found afterwards that he had sent touts all over the bazaar to announce the fact, told all the litigants, oh, you'd better come to my Vakil Mahmud Ali. He's in with the city magistrate. Ever since then, I've dropped on him and caught as hard as I could. It's taught me a lesson, and I hope him.
Isn't the lesson that you should invite all the pleaders to have a smoke with you?
Perhaps, but time's limited and the flesh weak. I prefer my smoke at the club, amongst my own sort, I'm afraid.
Why not ask the pleaders to the club?
Miss Quested persisted. I'm not allowed.
He was pleasant and patient, and evidently understood why she did not understand. He implied that he had once been a she, though not for long. Going to the veranda, he called firmly to the moon. His sais answered, and without lowering his head, he ordered his trap to be brought round. Mrs. Moore, whom the club had stupefied, woke up outside. She watched the moon, whose radiance stained with primrose the purple of the surrounding sky. In England, the moon had seemed dead and alien. Here she was caught in the shawl of night, together with Earth and all the other stars. A sudden sense of unity, of kinship with the heavenly bodies, passed into the old woman and out, like water through a tank, leaving a strange freshness behind. She did not dislike Cousin Kate or the national anthem, but their note had died into a new one, just as cocktails and cigars had died into invisible flowers. When the mosque, long and domeless, gleamed at the turn of the road, she exclaimed,
"Oh, yes, that's where I got to. That's where I've been."
"Been there when?" asked her son.
"Between the acts."
"But, Mother, you can't do that sort of thing."
"Can't, Mother?" she replied.
"No, really not in this country. It's not done. There's the danger from snakes, for one thing. They're apt to lie out in the evening."
"Ah, yes. So the young man there said." "This sounds very romantic," said Miss Quested, who was exceedingly fond of Mrs. Moore, and was glad she should have had this little escapade. "You meet a young man in a mosque, and then never let me know?" "I was going to tell you, Adela, but something changed the conversation, and I forgot. My memory grows deplorable." "Was he nice?"
She paused, then said emphatically,
"Very nice."
"Who was he?" Ronnie inquired.
"A doctor. I don't know his name."
"A doctor? I know of no young doctor in Chandrapur. How odd. What was he like?"
"Rather small, with a little moustache and quick eyes. He called out to me when I was in the dark part of the mosque about my shoes. That was how we began talking. He was afraid I had them on, but I remembered, luckily. He told me about his children, and then we walked back to the club. He knows you well."
"Have you a spare one?"
"Yes, yes, 1 minute."
"Not if you're wearing it yourself."
No, one in my pocket."
Stepping aside so that his outline might vanish, he wrenched off his collar and pulled out of his shirt the back stud, a gold stud, which was part of a set that his brother-in-law had brought him from Europe.
"Here it is," he cried.
"Come in with it if you don't mind the unconventionality."
1 minute again."
Replacing his collar, he prayed that it would not spring up at the back during tea. Fielding's bearer, who was helping him to dress, opened the door for him.
"Many thanks."
They shook hands, smiling. He began to look round, as he would have with any old friend. Fielding was not surprised at the rapidity of their intimacy. With so emotional a people, it was apt to come at once or never, and he and Aziz, having heard only good of each other, could afford to dispense with preliminaries.
"But I always thought that Englishmen kept their rooms so tidy. It seems that this is not so. I need not be so ashamed."
He sat down gaily on the bed, then, forgetting himself entirely, drew up his legs and folded them under him.
Everything ranged coldly on shelves was what I thought. I say, Mr. Fielding, is the stud going to go in?
Ahamadoots!
What's that last sentence, please? Will you teach me some new words and so improve my English?
Fielding doubted whether everything ranged coldly on shelves could be improved. He was often struck by the liveliness with which the younger generation handled a foreign tongue. They altered the idiom, but they could say whatever they wanted to say quickly. There were none of the babuisms ascribed to them at the club. But then the club moved slowly. It still declared that few Mohammedans and no Hindus would eat at an Englishman's table, and that all Indian ladies were in impenetrable purdah. Individually, it knew better. As a club, it declined to change.
Let me put in your stud.
I see. The shirt back's hole is rather small, and to rip it wider a pity. Why in hell does one wear collars at all? Grumbled Fielding as he bent his neck.
We wear them to pass the police.
What's that?
If I'm biking in English dress, starch collar, hat with ditch, they take no notice. When I wear a fez, they cry, "Your lamp's out!" Lord Curzon did not consider this when he urged natives of India to retain their picturesque costumes. Hooray! Stud's gone in. Sometimes I shut my eyes and dream I have splendid clothes again and am riding into battle behind Alamgir. Mr. Fielding, must not India have been beautiful then, with the Mughal Empire at its height and Alamgir reigning at Delhi upon the peacock throne?
Two ladies are coming to tea to meet you. I think you know them.
Meet me? I know no ladies.
Not Mrs. Moore and Miss Quested?
Oh, yes, I remember.
The romance at the mosque had sunk out of his consciousness as soon as it was over.
An excessively aged lady. But will you please repeat the name of her companion?
Miss Quested.
Just as you wish.
He was disappointed that other guests were coming, for he preferred to be alone with his new friend.
You can talk to Miss Quested about the peacock throne if you like. She is artistic, they say.
Is she a post-impressionist?
Post-impressionism, indeed. Come along to tea. This world is getting too much for me altogether.
What made you call it a ghost?
A call what a ghost?
The animal thing that hit us. Didn't you say, oh, a ghost, in passing?
I couldn't have been thinking of what I was saying.
It was probably a hyena, as a matter of fact.
Ah, very likely.
And they went on with their patience. Down in Chandrapur, the Nawab Bahadur waited for his car. He sat behind his townhouse, a small, unfurnished building which he rarely entered, in the midst of the little court that always improvises itself round Indians of position. As if turbans were the natural product of darkness, a fresh one would occasionally froth to the front, incline itself towards him, and retire. He was preoccupied. His diction was appropriate to a religious subject. 9 years previously, when first he had had a car, he had driven it over a drunken man and killed him, and the man had been waiting for him ever since. The Nawab Bahadur was innocent before God and the law. He had paid double the compensation necessary. But it was no use. The man continued to wait in an unspeakable form, close to the scene of his death. None of the English people knew of this, nor did the chauffeur. It was a racial secret communicable more by blood than speech. He spoke now in horror of the particular circumstances. He had led others into danger. He had risked the lives of two innocent and honoured guests. He repeated,
"If I had been killed, what matter? It must happen sometime. But they who trusted me..."
The company shuddered and invoked the mercy of God. Only Aziz held aloof, because a personal experience restrained him. Was it not by despising ghosts that he had come to know Mrs. Moore?
"You know Nuruddin?"
he whispered to the grandson, an effeminate youth whom he seldom met, always liked, and invariably forgot.
You know, my dear fellow, we Muslims simply must get rid of these superstitions, or India will never advance. How long must I hear of the savage pig upon the Marabar Road? Nuruddin looked down. Aziz continued, Your grandfather belongs to another generation, and I respect and love the old gentleman, as you know. I say nothing against him, only that it is wrong for us, because we are young. I want you to promise me, Nuruddin, are you listening? Not to believe in evil spirits, and if I die, for my health grows very weak, to bring up my three children to disbelieve in them too. Nuruddin smiled, and a suitable answer rose to his pretty lips, but before he could make it, the car arrived, and his grandfather took him away. The game of patience up in the civil lines went on longer than this. Mrs. Moore continued to murmur, Red 10 on a black knave, Miss Quested to assist her, and to intersperse among the intricacies of the play details about the hyena, the engagement, the Maharani of Madkul, the Bhattacharyas, and the day generally, whose rough, desiccated surface acquired, as it receded, a definite outline, as India itself might, could it be viewed from the moon. Presently, the players went to bed, but not before other people had woken up elsewhere, people whose emotions they could not share, and whose existence they ignored. Never tranquil, never perfectly dark, the night wore itself away, distinguished from other nights by two or three blasts of wind which seemed to fall perpendicularly out of the sky and to bounce back into it, hard and compact, leaving no freshness behind them. The hot weather was approaching. Mohammed Latif had bribed Anthony not to come. They walked up and down the platform, talking usefully. They agreed that they had overdone the servants and must leave two or three behind at Marabar Station. And Aziz explained that he might be playing one or two practical jokes at the caves, not out of unkindness, but to make the guests laugh. The old man assented with slight, sideway motions of the head. He was always willing to be ridiculed, and he bade Aziz not spare him. Elated by his importance, he began an indecent anecdote.
Tell me another time, brother, when I have more leisure. For now, as I have already explained, we have to give pleasure to non-Muslims. Three will be Europeans, one a Hindu, which must not be forgotten. Every attention must be paid to Professor Godbole, lest he feel that he is inferior to my other guests.
I will discuss philosophy with him.
That will be kind of you. But the servants are even more important. We must not convey an impression of disorganization. It can be done, and I expect you to do it.
A shriek from the purdah carriage. The train had started.
A merciful God!
Cried Mohammed Latif. He flung himself at the train and leapt onto the footboard of a carriage. Aziz did likewise. It was an easy feat, for a branch-like train is slow to assume special airs.
We are monkeys, don't worry,
he called, hanging onto a bar and laughing. Then he howled,
Mr. Fielding! Mr. Fielding!
There were Fielding and old Godbole held up at the level crossing. Appalling catastrophe. The gates had been closed earlier than usual. They leapt from their tonga. They gesticulated. But what was the good? So near and yet so far. As the train joggled past over the points, there was time for agonized words.
Bad, bad, you have destroyed me.
Godbole's puja did it, cried the Englishman.
The Brahmin lowered his eyes, ashamed of religion, for it was so. He had miscalculated the length of a prayer.
Jump on, I must have you,
screamed Aziz beside himself.
Right, give a hand. He's not tall, he'll kill himself,
Mrs. Moore protested. He jumped. He failed, missed his friend's hand, and fell back onto the line. The train rumbled past. He scrambled onto his feet and bawled after them.
I'm all right. You're all right. Don't worry.
And then they passed beyond range of his voice.
Mrs. Moore, Miss Quested, our expedition is a ruin.
He swung himself along the footboard, almost in tears.
Get in, get in. You'll kill yourself as well as Mr. Fielding. I see no ruin.
How is that? Oh, explain to me, he said piteously, like a child.
We shall be all Moslems together now, as you promised.
She was perfect as always, his dear Mrs. Moore. All the love for her he had felt at the mosque welled up again, the fresher for forgetfulness. There was nothing he would not do for her. He would die to make her happy.
Get in, Dr. Aziz, you make us giddy, the other lady called. If they're so foolish as to miss the train, that's their loss, not ours.
I am to blame. I am the host.
Nonsense. Go to your carriage. We're going to have a delightful time without them.
Not perfect like Mrs. Moore, but very sincere and kind. Wonderful ladies, both of them, and for one precious morning his guests. He felt important and competent. Fielding was a loss personally, being a friend, increasingly dear. Yet, if Fielding had come, he himself would have remained in leading strings. Indians are incapable of responsibility, said the officials, and Hamidullah sometimes said so too. He would show those pessimists that they were wrong. Smiling proudly, he glanced outward at the country, which was still invisible except as a dark movement in the darkness, then upwards at the sky, where the stars of the sprawling scorpion had begun to pale. Then he dived through a window into a second-class carriage.
Mohammed Latif, by the way, what is in these caves, brother? Why are we all going to see them?
Such a question was beyond the poor relative's scope. He could only reply that God and the local villagers knew, and that the latter would gladly act as guides.
Chapter 18. Mr. McBride, the district superintendent of police, was the most reflective and best educated of the Chandrapur officials. He had read and thought a good deal, and owing to a somewhat unhappy marriage, had evolved a complete philosophy of life. There was much of the cynic about him, but nothing of the bully. He never lost his temper or grew rough, and he received Aziz with courtesy, was almost reassuring.
"I have to detain you until you get bail," he said. "But no doubt your friends will be applying for it, and of course they will be allowed to visit you, under regulations. I am given certain information and have to act on it. I am not your judge."
Aziz was led off weeping. Mr. McBride was shocked at his downfall, but no Indian ever surprised him, because he had a theory about climatic zones. The theory ran, all unfortunate natives are criminals at heart, for the simple reason that they live south of latitude 30. They are not to blame, they have not a dog's chance. We should be like them if we settled here. Born at Karachi, he seemed to contradict his theory, and would sometimes admit as much, with a sad, quiet smile.
Another of them found out, he thought, as he set to work to draft his statement to the magistrate.
He was interrupted by the arrival of Fielding. He imparted all he knew without reservations. Miss Derrick had herself driven in the Mudkul car an hour ago, she and Miss Quested both in a terrible state. They had gone straight to his bungalow where he happened to be, and there and then he had taken down the charge and arranged for the arrest at the railway station.
What is the charge, precisely? That he followed her into the cave and made insulting advances. She hit at him with her field glasses. He pulled at them, the strap broke, and that is how she got away. When we searched him just now, they were in his pocket.
Oh, no. Oh, no, no. It'll be cleared up in 5 minutes, he cried again. Have a look at them.
The strap had been newly broken. The eyepiece was jammed. The logic of evidence said, guilty.
Did she say any more? There was an echo that appears to have frightened her. Did you go into those caves?
I saw one of them. There was an echo. Did it get on her nerves?
I couldn't worry her over much with questions. She'll have plenty to go through in the witness box. They don't bear thinking about these next weeks. I wish the Marabar Hills and all they contain were at the bottom of the sea.
Evening after evening, one saw them from the club, and they were just a harmless name. Yes, we start already.
For a visiting card was brought.
Aziz, have I made a mistake?
You're overtired, he cried, not much surprised.
Ronnie, he's innocent. I made an awful mistake.
Well, sit down anyhow. He looked round the room, but only two sparrows were chasing one another. She obeyed and took hold of his hand. He stroked it, and she smiled, and gasped as if she had risen to the surface of the water, then touched her ear.
My echo's better.
That's good. You'll be perfectly well in a few days. But you must save yourself up for the trial. Das is a very good fellow. We shall all be with you.
But Ronnie, dear Ronnie, perhaps there oughtn't to be any trial.
I don't quite know what you're saying, and I don't think you do.
If Dr. Aziz never did it, he ought to be let out.
A shiver like impending death passed over Ronnie. He said hurriedly, he was let out, until the Murrum riot, when he had to be put in again. To divert her, he told her the story, which was held to be amusing. Nuruddin had stolen the Nawab Bahadur's car and driven Aziz into a ditch in the dark. Both of them had fallen out, and Nuruddin had cut his face open. Their wailing had been drowned by the cries of the faithful, and it was quite a time before they were rescued by the police. Nuruddin was taken to the Minto Hospital, Aziz restored to prison, with an additional charge against him of disturbing the public peace. "Half a minute," he remarked when the anecdote was over, and went to the telephone to ask Calendar to look in as soon as he found it convenient, because she hadn't borne the journey well. When he returned, she was in nervous crisis, but it took a different form. She clung to him and sobbed,
"Help me to do what I ought. Aziz is good. You heard your mother say so."
"Heard what?"
"He's good. I've been so wrong to accuse him."
"A mother never said so."
"Didn't she?"
she asked, quite reasonable, open to every suggestion anyway.
"She never mentioned that name once."
"But, Ronnie, I heard her."
"A pure illusion. You can't be quite well, can you, to make up a thing like that?"
"I suppose I can't. How amazing of me."
"I was listening to all she said, as far as it could be listened to. She gets very incoherent."
"When her voice dropped, she said it, towards the end, when she talked about love. Love, I couldn't follow, but just then she said, Dr. Aziz never did it."
"Those words?"
"The idea more than the words."
"Never, never, my dear girl. Complete illusion. His name was not mentioned by anyone. Look here, you are confusing this with Fielding's letter."
"That's it. That's it," she cried, greatly relieved. "I knew I'd heard his name somewhere. I'm so grateful to you for clearing this up. It's the sort of mistake that worries me and proves I'm neurotic."
"So you won't go saying he's innocent again, will you? For every servant I've got is a spy."
He went to the window. The Mali had gone, or rather had turned into two small children. Impossible they should know English, but he sent them packing.
"They all hate us," he explained. "It'll be all right after the verdict, for I will say this for them. They do accept the accomplished fact. But at present they're pouring out money like water to catch us tripping, and a remark like yours is the very thing they look out for. It would enable them to say it was a put-up job on the part of us officials. You see what I mean?"
Mrs. Moore came back with the same air of ill-temper and sat down with a flump by the card table. To clear the confusion up, Ronnie asked her point-blank whether she had mentioned the prisoner. She could not understand the question, and the reason of it had to be explained. She replied,
"I never said his name," and began to play patience.
She tried to remember what she had felt in court, but could not. The vision disappeared whenever she wished to interpret it.
"Events presented themselves to me in their logical sequence,"
was what she said, but it hadn't been that at all. "My belief, and of course I was listening carefully, in hope you would make some slip, my belief is that poor McBride exorcised you. As soon as he asked you a straightforward question, you gave a straightforward answer and broke down."
"Exorcise in that sense? I thought you meant I'd seen a ghost."
"I don't go to that length."
"People whom I respect very much believe in ghosts," she said rather sharply. "My friend Mrs. Moore does."
She's an old lady.
I think you need not be impolite to her, as well as to her son.
I did not intend to be rude. I only meant it is difficult, as we get on in life, to resist the supernatural. I felt it coming on me myself. I still jog on without it, but what a temptation at 45 to pretend that the dead live again. One's own dead. No one else's matter.
Because the dead don't live again.
I fear not.
So do I.
There was a moment's silence, such as often follows the triumph of rationalism. Then he apologized handsomely enough for his behavior to Heslop at the club.
"What does Dr. Aziz say of me?"
she asked after another pause.
He has not been capable of thought in his misery. Naturally, he is very bitter," said Fielding, a little awkward, because such remarks as Aziz had made were not merely bitter, they were foul. The underlying notion was, "It disgraces me to have been mentioned in connection with such a hag." It enraged him that he had been accused by a woman who had no personal beauty. Sexually, he was a snob. This had puzzled and worried Fielding. Sensuality, as long as it is straightforward, did not repel him. But this derived sensuality, the sort that classes a mistress among motor cars if she is beautiful, and among eyeflies if she isn't, was alien to his own emotions, and he felt a barrier between himself and Aziz whenever it arose. It was, in a new form, the old, old trouble that eats the heart out of every civilization. Snobbery, the desire for possessions, creditable appendages. And it is to escape this, rather than the lusts of the flesh, that saints retreat into the Himalayas. To change the subject, he said, "But let me conclude my analysis. We are agreed that he is not a villain, and that you are not one, and we aren't really sure that it was an hallucination. There's a fourth possibility which we must touch on. Was it somebody else?"
"The guide."
"Exactly, the guide. I often think so. Unluckily, Aziz hit him on the face, and he got a fright and disappeared. It is most unsatisfactory, and we hadn't the police to help us. The guide was of no interest to them."
"Perhaps it was the guide," she said quietly.
The question had lost interest for her suddenly.
"Or could it have been one of that gang of Pathans who have been drifting through the district?"
"Someone who was in another cave and followed me when the guide was looking away. Possibly."
At that moment, Hamidullah joined them and seemed not too pleased to find them closeted together. Like everyone else in Chandrapur, he could make nothing of Miss Quested's conduct. He had overheard their last remarks.
"Hello, my dear Fielding," he said. "So I run you down at last. Can you come out at once to Dilkusha?" "At once?"
"I hope to leave in a moment. Don't let me interrupt," said Adela.
"The telephone has been broken. Miss Quested can't ring up her friends," he explained. "A great deal has been broken, more than will ever be mended," said the other. "Still, there should be some way of transporting this lady back to the civil lines. The resources of civilization are numerous."
He spoke without looking at Miss Quested, and he ignored the slight movement she made towards him with her hand. Chapter 31 Aziz had no sense of evidence. The sequence of his emotions decided his beliefs and led to the tragic coolness between himself and his English friend. They had conquered, but were not to be crowned. Fielding was away at a conference, and after the rumour about Miss Quested had been with him undisturbed for a few days, he assumed it was true. He had no objection on moral grounds to his friends amusing themselves, and Cyril, being middle-aged, could no longer expect the pick of the female market and must take his amusement where he could find it. But he resented him making up to this particular woman, whom he still regarded as his enemy. Also, why had he not been told? What is friendship without confidence? He himself had told things sometimes regarded as shocking, and the Englishman had listened, tolerant, but surrendering nothing in return. He met Fielding at the railway station on his return, agreed to dine with him, and then started taxing him by the oblique method, outwardly merry.
an avowed European scandal there was, Mr. McBride and Miss Derrick. Miss Derrick's faithful attachment to Chandrapur was now explained. Mr. McBride had been caught in her room, and his wife was divorcing him.
That pure-minded fellow. However, he will blame the Indian climate. Everything is our fault, really.
Now, have I not discovered an important piece of news for you, Cyril?
Not very, said Fielding, who took little interest in distant sins. Listen to mine.
Aziz's face lit up.
At the conference, it was settled.
This evening will do for schoolmastery. I should go straight to the Minto now. The cholera looks bad. We begin to have local cases as well as imported. In fact, the whole of life is somewhat sad. The new civil surgeon is the same as the last, but does not yet dare to be. That is all any administrative change amounts to. All my suffering has won nothing for us. But look here, Cyril, while I remember it. There's gossip about you as well as McBride. They say that you and Miss Quested became also rather too intimate friends. To speak perfectly frankly, they say you and she have been guilty of impropriety.
They would say that.
It's all over the town, and may injure your reputation. You know, everyone is by no means your supporter. I have tried all I could to silence such a story.
Don't bother. Miss Quested has cleared out at last.
It is those who stop in the country, not those who leave it, whom such a story injures. Imagine my dismay and anxiety. I could scarcely get a wink of sleep. First my name was coupled with her, and now it is yours.
Don't use such exaggerated phrases.
As what?
As dismay and anxiety.
Have I not lived all my life in India? Do I not know what produces a bad impression here?
His voice shot up rather crossly. Yes, but the scale, the scale. You always get the scale wrong, my dear fellow. A pity there is this rumour, but such a very small pity, so small that we may as well talk of something else.
You mind for Miss Quested's sake, though, I can see from your face.
As far as I do mind, I travel light.
Cyril, that boastfulness about travelling light will be your ruin. It is raising up enemies against you on all sides, and makes me feel excessively uneasy.
What enemies?
Since Aziz had only himself in mind, he could not reply. Feeling a fool, he became angrier. I have given you list after list of people who cannot be trusted in this city. In your position, I should have the sense to know I was surrounded by enemies. You observe I speak in a low voice. It is because I see your sias is new.
Ralph Moore came into the light. What a strange-looking youth. Tall, prematurely aged, the big blue eyes faded with anxiety, the hair impoverished and tousled. Not a type that is often exported imperially. The doctor in Aziz thought, born of too old a mother. The poet found him rather beautiful.
I was unable to call earlier owing to pressure of work. How are the celebrated bee stings? He asked patronizingly.
I was resting. They thought I had better. They throb, rather.
His timidity and evident newness had complicated effects on the malcontent. Speaking threateningly, he said,
Come here, please. Allow me to look.
They were practically alone, and he could treat the patient as Calendar had treated Nureddin.
You said this morning...
The best of doctors make mistakes. Come here, please, for the diagnosis under the lamp. I am pressed for time.
Oh!
What is the matter, pray?
Your hands are unkind.
He started and glanced down at them. The extraordinary youth was right, and he put them behind his back before replying with outward anger,
What the devil have my hands to do with you? This is a most strange remark. I am a qualified doctor who will not hurt you.
I don't mind pain. There is no pain.
No pain?
Not really.
Excellent news, sneered Aziz.
But there is cruelty.
I have brought you some salve, but how to put it on in your present nervous state becomes a problem, he continued after a pause.
Please leave it with me.
Certainly not. It returns to my dispensary at once.
He stretched forward, and the other retreated to the further side of a table. "Now, do you want me to treat your stings, or do you prefer an English doctor? There is one at Asirgar. Asirgar is 40 miles away, and the Ringnord Dam broken. Now you see how you are placed. I think I had better see Mr. Fielding about you. This is really great nonsense, your present behaviour."
"They are out in a boat," he replied, glancing about him for support.
Aziz feigned intense surprise.
"They have not gone in the direction of Mao, I hope. On a night like this, the people become most fanatical."
And as if to confirm him, there was a sob, as though the lips of a giant had parted. The procession was approaching the jail.
"You should not treat us like this," he challenged. And this time, Aziz was checked, for the voice, though frightened, was not weak.
"Like what?"
"Dr. Aziz, we have done you no harm."
"Aha, you know my name, I see. Yes, I am Aziz. No, of course, your great friend, Miss Quested, did me no harm at the Marabar."
Drowning his last words, all the guns of the state went off. A rocket from the jail garden gave the signal. The prisoner had been released and was kissing the feet of the singers. Rose leaves fall from the houses. Sacred spices and coconut are brought forth. It was the halfway moment. The god had extended his temple and paused exultantly. Mixed and confused in their passage, the rumors of salvation entered the guest house. They were startled and moved onto the porch, drawn by the sudden illumination. The bronze gun up on the fort kept flashing. The town was a blur of light, in which the house seemed dancing and the palace waving little wings. The water below, the hills and sky above, were not involved as yet. There was still only a little light and song struggling among the shapeless lumps of the universe.
"I wish you had pointed him out to me. I can't make out who he is."
"He didn't come into the club. He said he wasn't allowed to."
Thereupon, truth struck him, and he cried,
"Oh, good gracious! Not a Mohammedan! Why ever didn't you tell me you'd been talking to a native? I was going all wrong."
"A Mohammedan? Perfectly magnificent," exclaimed Miss Quested. "Ronnie, isn't that like your mother? While we were talking about seeing the real India, she goes and sees it, and then forgets she's seen it."
But Ronnie was ruffled. From his mother's description, he had thought the doctor might be young Muggins from over the Ganges, and had brought out all the comradely emotions. What a mix-up! Why hadn't she indicated by the tone of her voice that she was talking about an Indian? Scratchy and dictatorial, he began to question her.
"He called to you in the mosque, did he? How? Impudently? What was he doing there himself at that time of night? No, it's not their prayer time."
This in answer to a suggestion of Miss Quested's, who showed the keenest interest.
"So, he called to you over your shoes. Then it was impudence. It's an old trick. I wish you had had them on."
"I think it was impudence, but I don't know about a trick," said Mrs. Moore. "His nerves were all on edge. I could tell from his voice. As soon as I answered, he altered."
"You oughtn't to have answered."
"Now look here," said the logical girl. "Wouldn't you expect a Mohammedan to answer if you asked him to take off his hat in church?"
"It's different, it's different. You don't understand."
"I know I don't, and I want to. What is the difference, please?"
He wished she wouldn't interfere. His mother did not signify. She was just a globetrotter, a temporary escort who could retire to England with what impression she chose. But Adela, who meditated spending her life in the country, was a more serious matter. It would be tiresome if she started crooked over the native question. Pulling up the mare, he said,
"There's your Ganges."
Their attention was diverted. Below them, a radiance had suddenly appeared. It belonged neither to water nor moonlight, but stood like a luminous sheaf upon the fields of darkness. He told them that it was where the new sandbank was forming, and that the dark, ravelled bit at the top was the sand, and that the dead bodies floated down that way from Benares, or would, if the crocodiles let them.
"It's not much of a dead body that gets down to Chandrapur."
"Crocodiles down in it too. How terrible," his mother murmured.
The young people glanced at each other and smiled. It amused them when the old lady got these gentle creeps, and harmony was restored between them consequently. She continued,
"What a terrible river! What a wonderful river!"
and sighed. The radiance was already altering, whether through shifting of the moon or of the sand. Soon the bright sheaf would be gone, and a circlet, itself to alter, be burnished upon the streaming void. The women discussed whether they would wait for the change or not, while the silence broke into patches of unquietness, and the mare shivered. On her account, they did not wait, but drove on to the city magistrate's bungalow, where Miss Quested went to bed, and Mrs. Moore had a short interview with her son. He wanted to inquire about the Mohammedan doctor in the mosque. It was his duty to report suspicious characters, and conceivably it was some disreputable Hakim who had prowled up from the bazaar. When she told him that it was someone connected with the Minto Hospital, he was relieved, and said that the fellow's name must be Aziz, and that he was quite all right, nothing against him at all.
Aziz, what a charming name.
So, you and he had a talk. Did you gather he was well-disposed?
Ignorant of the force of this question, she replied,
Yes, quite, after the first moment.
I meant generally.
Aziz was offended. The remark suggested that he, an obscure Indian, had no right to have heard of post-impressionism, a privilege reserved for the ruling race, that. He said stiffly,
I do not consider Mrs. Moore my friend. I only met her accidentally in my mosque.
And was adding, A single meeting is too short to make a friend. But before he could finish the sentence, the stiffness vanished from it, because he felt Fielding's fundamental goodwill. His own went out to it, and grappled beneath the shifting tides of emotion, which can alone bear the voyager to an anchorage, but may also carry him across it onto the rocks. He was safe, really, as safe as the shore-dweller who can only understand stability and supposes that every ship must be wrecked, and he had sensations the shore-dweller cannot know. Indeed, he was sensitive rather than responsive. In every remark he found a meaning, but not always the true meaning, and his life, though vivid, was largely a dream. Fielding, for instance, had not meant that Indians are obscure, but that post-impressionism is. A gulf divided his remark from Mrs. Turton's,
Why, they speak English!
But to Aziz, the two sounded alike. Fielding saw that something had gone wrong, and equally that it had come right, but he didn't fidget, being an optimist where personal relations were concerned, and their talk rattled on as before.
Besides the ladies, I am expecting one of my assistants, Narayan Godbole.
Oh-ho, the Deccani Brahmin.
He wants the past back too, but not precisely Alamgir.
I should think not. Do you know what Deccani Brahmins say? That England conquered India from them. From them, mind, and not from the Mughals. Is not that like their cheek? They have even bribed it to appear in textbooks, for they are so subtle and immensely rich. Professor Godbole must be quite unlike all other Deccani Brahmins, from all I can hear say. A most sincere chap.
Why don't you fellows run a club in Chandrapur, Aziz?
Perhaps some day. Just now I see Mrs. Moore and, what's her name, coming.
How fortunate that it was an unconventional party, where formalities are ruled out. On this basis, Aziz found the English ladies easy to talk to. He treated them like men. Beauty would have troubled him, for it entails rules of its own. But Mrs. Moore was so old, and Miss Quested so plain, that he was spared this anxiety. Adela's angular body and the freckles on her face were terrible defects in his eyes, and he wondered how God could have been so unkind to any female form. His attitude towards her remained entirely straightforward in consequence.
"I want to ask you something, Dr. Aziz," she began. "I heard from Mrs. Moore how helpful you were to her in the mosque, and how interesting. She learnt more about India in those few minutes' talk with you than in the 3 weeks since we landed."
"Oh, please, do not mention a little thing like that.
Is there anything else I may tell you about my country? I want you to explain a disappointment we had this morning. It must be some point of Indian etiquette.
There honestly is none, he replied. We are by nature a most informal people.
I am afraid we must have made some blunder and given offence, said Mrs. Moore.
That is even more impossible. But may I know the facts?
Chapter 9. Aziz fell ill as he foretold. Slightly ill. 3 days later, he lay abed in his bungalow, pretending to be very ill. It was a touch of fever, which he would have neglected if there was anything important at the hospital. Now and then he groaned and thought he should die, but did not think so for long, and a very little diverted him. It was Sunday, always an equivocal day in the East, and an excuse for slacking. He could hear church bells as he drowsed, both from the civil station and from the missionaries out beyond the slaughterhouse. Different bells and rung with different intent, for one set was calling firmly to Anglo-India and the other feebly to mankind. He did not object to the first set. The other he ignored, knowing their inefficiency. Old Mr. Graysford and young Mr. Sawley made converts during a famine because they distributed food, but when times improved, they were naturally left alone again, and though surprised and aggrieved each time this happened, they never learnt wisdom. No Englishman understands us except Mr. Fielding, he thought. But how shall I see him again? If he entered this room, the disgrace of it would kill me. He called to Hassan to clear up, but Hassan, who was testing his wages by ringing them on the step of the veranda, found it possible not to hear him. Heard and didn't hear, just as Aziz had called and hadn't called. That's India all over. How like us. There we are. He dozed again, and his thoughts wandered over the varied surface of life. Gradually, they steadied upon a certain spot, the bottomless pit, according to missionaries, but he had never regarded it as more than a dimple. Yes, he did want to spend an evening with some girls, singing and all that, the vague jollity that would culminate in voluptuousness. Yes, that was what he did want. How could it be managed? If Major Callender had been an Indian, he would have remembered what young men are and granted 2 or 3 days' leave to Calcutta without asking questions. But the Major assumed either that his subordinates were made of ice or that they repaired to the Chandrapur bazaars. Disgusting ideas, both. It was only Mr. Fielding who... Hassan! The servant came running. Look at those flies, brother! And he pointed to the horrible mass that hung from the ceiling. The nucleus was a wire which had been inserted as a homage to electricity. Electricity had paid no attention, and a colony of eye flies had come instead and blackened the coils with their bodies.
Hazur, those are flies.
Good, good, they are, excellent. But why have I called you?
To drive them elsewhere, said Hassan, after painful thought. Driven elsewhere, they always return. Hazur, you must make some arrangement against flies. That is why you are my servant, said Aziz gently.
Hassan would call the little boy to borrow the stepladder from Mahmud Ali's house. He would order the cook to light the primer stove and heat water. He would personally ascend the steps with a bucket in his arms and dip the end of the coil into it.
Good, very good. Now, what have you to do? Kill flies.
Good. Do it. Hassan withdrew, the plan almost lodged in his head, and began to look for the little boy. Not finding him, his steps grew slower, and he stole back to his post on the veranda, but did not go on testing his rupees in case his master heard them clink.
Chapter 14. Most of life is so dull that there is nothing to be said about it, and the books and talk that would describe it as interesting are obliged to exaggerate in the hope of justifying their own existence. Inside its cocoon of work or social obligation, the human spirit slumbers for the most part, registering the distinction between pleasure and pain,
but not nearly as alert as we pretend. There are periods in the most thrilling day during which nothing happens, and though we continue to exclaim, "I do enjoy myself," or "I am horrified," we are insincere. As far as I feel anything, it is enjoyment, horror. It's no more than that, really, and a perfectly adjusted organism would be silent. It so happened that Mrs. Moore and Miss Quested had felt nothing acutely for a fortnight. Ever since Professor Godbole had sung his queer little song, they had lived more or less inside cocoons, and the difference between them was that the elder lady accepted her own apathy, while the younger resented hers. It was Adela's faith that the whole stream of events is important and interesting, and if she grew bored, she blamed herself severely and compelled her lips to utter enthusiasms. This was the only insincerity in a character otherwise sincere, and it was indeed the intellectual protest of her youth. She was particularly vexed now because she was both in India and engaged to be married, which double event should have made every instant sublime. India was certainly dim this morning, though seen under the auspices of Indians. Her wish had been granted, but too late. She could not get excited over Aziz and his arrangements. She was not the least unhappy or depressed, and the various odd objects that surrounded her, the comic Purda carriage, the piles of rugs and bolsters, the rolling melons, the scent of sweet oils, the ladder, the brass-bound box, the sudden eruption of Mahmud Ali's butler from the lavatory with tea and poached eggs upon a tray. They were all new and amusing, and led her to comment appropriately, but they wouldn't bite into her mind. So she tried to find comfort by reflecting that her main interest would henceforward be Ronnie.
What a nice, cheerful servant. What a relief after Antony. They startle one, rather. A strange place to make tea in, said Mrs. Moore, who had hoped for a nap. I want to sack Antony. His behaviour on the platform has decided me.
Mrs. Moore thought that Antony's better self would come to the front at Simla. Miss Quested was to be married at Simla. Some cousins, with a house looking straight onto Tibet, had invited her.
Anyhow, we must get a second servant, because at Simla you will be at the hotel, and I don't think Ronnie's Baldeo.
She loved plans.
Very well. You get another servant, and I'll keep Antony with me. I am used to his unappetizing ways. He will see me through the hot weather.
I don't believe in the hot weather. People like Major Callender, who always talk about it, it's in the hope of making one feel inexperienced and small, like their everlasting, I've been 20 years in this country.
I believe in the hot weather, but never did I suppose it would bottle me up as it will.
For owing to the sage leisureliness of Ronnie and Adela, they could not be married till May, and consequently Mrs. Moore could not return to England immediately after the wedding, which was what she had hoped to do. By May, a barrier of fire would have fallen across India and the adjoining sea, and she would have to remain perched up in the Himalayas, waiting for the world to get cooler.
I won't be bottled up, announced the girl. I've no patience with these women here who leave their husbands grilling in the plains.
Vakil Mahmud Ali, legal adviser to the prisoner, asked to be allowed to see him. McBride sighed, gave permission, and continued.
I heard some more from Miss Derrick. She is an old friend of us both and talks freely. Well, her account is that you went off to locate the camp, and almost at once she heard stones falling on the Kawa Dol and saw Miss Quested running straight down the face of a precipice. Well, she climbed up a sort of gully to her and found her practically done for, her helmet off.
Was a guide not with her? Interrupted Fielding.
No. She had got among some cactuses. Miss Derrick saved her life coming just then. She was beginning to fling herself about. She helped her down to the car. Miss Quested couldn't stand the Indian driver, cried, "Keep him away!" And it was that that put our friend on the track of what had happened. They made straight for our bungalow and are there now. That's the story as far as I know it yet. She sent the driver to join you. I think she behaved with great sense. I suppose there's no possibility of my seeing Miss Quested? He asked suddenly. I